Good evening and welcome to City Visions. This is Grace Wan. Do your genes determine how your body processes calories? Is a low-carb diet superior to a low-fat diet? Will personalized diets lead to a slimmer, healthier population? Tonight, we delve into a Stanford study published recently in the Journal of the American Medical Association that provides new answers about the interaction between genes, diet, and overall health. Obesity and related conditions such as diabetes, certain cancers, and heart disease are some of the major public health challenges of our day. They're expensive, complex, and often intractable. The scientific community is working hard to understand what is going on with our bodies and what can be done about it. All this research results in a constant flow of new, often contradictory, guidelines on diet and health. From low-carb diets to intermittent fasting to probiotics and prebiotics, what do we need to do to eat well? To help us establish what is known about a diet for optimal health and weight, we are pleased to have Dr. Christopher Gardner, the Director of Nutrition Studies at the Stanford Prevention Research Center and Professor of Medicine at Stanford University. Welcome, Christopher.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We're happy to have you. And we also have Susan Kirkpatrick, a registered dietitian and certified diabetes educator at Anara Health in San Mateo. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you for allowing me to be here tonight.
Oh, we're glad to have you. And in 20 minutes, we will invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us by sending us a tweet at cityvisionskalw. Are you confused about dietary guidelines and what to eat? Do you think your body responds differently to food than those of your friends and family? Call us with your questions and concerns. So, Christopher and Susan, this study that we're talking about received a great deal of press last month in February. And Christopher, can you describe the study that was conducted and why it is so significant?
Sure. Well, I don't want to be egotistical. I don't know how significant it is, but it sure got a lot of press. And it was a large study for a weight loss study. It's 609 people for a year. And for most studies, that's more people and longer than most people do these. The two diets being compared were low-fat and low-carb, and we always refer to them as healthy low-carb and healthy low-fat. I'd love to get into that soon. After 12 months, they lost 6,500 pounds collectively.
Wow.
The average weight loss in one group was 12 and the other was 13, which is pretty meaningless after a whole year. But the much more interesting thing, which is what we knew going into it was going to happen, is on both diet groups, somebody lost 40 and 50 and 60 pounds. And in both diet groups, somebody gained 10 and 15 and 20 pounds, which obviously sucks, gaining weight on a weight loss study. There is this 80-pound range of difference in the same, within the same diets. And to be honest, this actually goes back, if you'll allow me, a decade ago when we published another study where we really just took some popular diet books. We took the Atkins, the Zone, and the Ornish books, and we took a health professional's approach, and we pitted four diets against one another with 311 women who all wanted to lose 15 to 100 pounds. And at the end of the day, it was kind of similar. There were a few pound difference between them, but we saw this same range. And when we publish our studies in medical journals, we're usually supposed to use an average, and we show some sign of the variability, but we focus on the 100 because we want to avoid outliers. There weren't really any outliers in this. There was everything in between, from losing 60 to gaining 20. And so when we made our main graphic for the paper, that was sort of ho-hum, and then we made another graphic where we showed every single individual in what we call a waterfall plot. So every one is represented, and you can see we set them up from losing the most to being the least successful. And so people's jaws were dropping open, saying, you know, I never really appreciated how variable it is within those groups. I don't get that looking at the medical journals, but it kind of resonates with everybody. So I think I heard this in the opening to the show. Kind of everybody seems to know someone who tried a diet and did really well on it, and somebody tried to copy them and didn't do as well.
Right.
Because they just didn't do it, or was there really something different about them? So the whole point of our study was we thought we had this genotype pattern, and we thought we had a metabolic marker that had to do with insulin and glucose. And we figured we weren't really looking to see if low carb or low fat were better. We were trying to see which diet was best for whom, and if we had some markers that we could use to help predict this. And the bottom line of the study was nine of the things that we thought would predict the difference worked, and yet they still lost 6,500 pounds, and they had this huge range within them. And so we have a lot of different data that we collected on them, and we have some ideas to move forward of what might have predicted it. But the two main things we were after did not.
Interesting.
That's the main gist of the study.
Well, tell us a little bit, Sue, about what is a healthy low-carb diet and a healthy low-fat diet? What does that look like?
Yeah, no problem. So what we mean by healthy is we told both groups, I mean, definitely with low-carb when they first started out, you know, we told them to cut their carbohydrates to about 20 grams in a day. And we did the same thing with the low-fat group. And so, like, low-carb, they would be eating lots of eggs and, you know, meats and lots of protein, etc. But we really, really stress within that group that it was like, you know, you had your eggs from chickens that were raised out in the pasture. And, you know, if you could do all these things and, you know, from cows that were grass-fed and really quality food. And on the low-fat side, you know, we stressed, you know, grains, you know, all those kinds of things and really good fats for the small amount they were going to have, etc. So it was really high quality low fat food, but within where the both groups crossed over were vegetables. Okay, for the low carb group at first it was, you know, okay, maybe you want to try to eliminate some starchy vegetables, but greens and tomatoes and all kinds of good things, these were promoted in both groups, so it was incredibly healthy, we thought. And of course we told both groups that get out sugar and get out a lot of processed foods in your diets. So that's what we mean by healthy.
So there are things that people were not allowed to eat or were recommended to not eat, and then there were other things that they were encouraged to eat.
That's correct. That is correct. And both groups were encouraged to eat almost, you know, in that vegetable group, almost the same thing, and, you know, and the same advice to get out the sugar, the high sugar things and the highly processed foods.
And, Christopher, were your study participants given menus for each day or just general guidelines of what they should eat on a regular basis?
Oh, that's such a great question. So in nutrition-type studies, we run the spectrum of rigor and control. And I'm just going to toss out that the most rigorous and controlled studies are the least generalizable, and the most generalizable studies can't be quite as rigorous. So one type of study is when you buy it for them, make it for them, slide it under the prison door, and lock them in the room with a camera on them. And if you can imagine, not many people sign up for that, and at the end of the day, it's hard to make that generalizable.
Well, that's the kind of study being in prison is what some diets might feel like, so yeah.
The kind of, that we prefer is Sue and four other magnificent health educators were responsible for teaching them. No food was handed out. There were some sample menus. There were many examples given. But the whole idea was that we were teaching them a new eating pattern. In fact, it was really fun. The health educators all kind of corrected me early on into the study that we really needed to stop referring to them as diets and
yes,
refer to them
we did.
as eating patterns. Because really what we had asked them to do was go as low as they could, and then assuming that that was probably too low for most of them, and we wanted to psychologically anchor them that way, we allowed them to add some back. We never had them actually count calories. We didn't give them a specific caloric restriction. We very specifically said, in the long run, if you're hungry, this is never going to work. So you need to titrate back up to a level of carb or fat where you're not feeling hungry or deprived, and you can look Sue or Christopher, some of the health educators, in the eye and say, you know, this is as low as I can go, but this is an eating pattern that I could potentially do for the rest of my life. If this thing works for me, I can keep doing this. This isn't a diet that I'm going to go off the minute the study ends. And so that was a really core principle that kind of worked out along the way with the health educators and the participants.
And Sue, who were the study participants? Were they patients at Stanford, or were they just people who volunteered? Are they middle-aged, older? Tell us a little bit about the demographic.
Yeah, they were from all over the Bay Area. I mean, there was one participant, I believe, is from as far as Petaluma, who would come to the Stanford in Palo Alto. And, you know, they were from East Bay, they were from South Bay, they were from, you know, they weren't patients in the hospital. Some worked in the hospital, but they were from all over, you know, the Bay Area as far as, you know, Petaluma. The demographic was less than 50 years old, I believe, and Christopher, correct me if I'm wrong, but at the time of, you know, the start of the study, because I remember one gentleman actually turned that while he was in the study, but that was okay. And they were men and women, and we did a really great job of trying to get, you know, an equal distribution there. Hmm. So they were working people. They were, you know, moms and dads at home. A lot of them were working people. But, yeah, just like people that you might know in your neighborhood kind of thing and you know, in the Bay Area.
And what kind of exercise was that? Was exercise a component of the study, or is that not something that you looked at, Christopher?
Oh, Sue should answer that. So really, we had them, we asked them to meet some guidelines, but we spent more time talking about food than about exercise. Sue, do you want to elaborate on that?
Sure. We did talk about it, yes. And we said, like at the beginning, you know, don't, you know, add more or change, you know, what you're doing and, you know, assess yourself. Because, you know, if some of these people were pretty going, you know, they were going eating less. And so, you know, but we did talk about it as being part of your eventual sustainable pattern or lifestyle. And again, Christopher is so right. We tried so hard to get away from the word diet.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about it in that respect, and many people were already exercising. So that's great. You know, keep doing what you're doing. And if you haven't, you know, just try to do something, again, that keeps, you know, with the food pattern that you're doing, you know, something you can do and you're not feeling exhausted and work into your day. So that's how we talked about it. So it was the basic, you know, the information was about around food and other things later on as well.
Well, Christopher, we talk a lot, we are hearing a lot in the world of medicine about genetics and how our genetics might play a part in our health and contracting illness. And I think what you're saying is that genotype didn't play much role in the losing weight or gaining weight in your study. Is that right?
Yeah, but let's put this in the appropriate context. So, you know, we have billions of genes. Of those related to being overweight, there are hundreds of them. Now, the ones that predict if you'll get heavy are not necessarily the same ones that will predict if you'll lose weight on a diet and which diet, so those could be completely different. We actually only worked with three genes. We had worked with a group previously. I had mentioned our older study from a decade ago. Mm-hmm. Somebody had gone back to look at that. They had a hypothesis. They found three specific genes where there's a lot of very common variations. We call these single nucleotide polymorphisms, which is a horrific name, I admit, or SNPs for short. So we had what we call a multi-locus genotype pattern, which really means there were three specific genes that we were able to look at that would express themselves differently in participants, and one set of the three looked like it could be a low-fat genotype pattern, and one set looked like it could be a low-carbohydrate genotype pattern. And so it was very interesting. About 35% of the population was one, and 40% was another. There was another 25% or so that weren't either of them. But with 609 people, there was plenty of representation on both sides, and it failed. And it failed to predict any difference. I want to be careful here. Several headlines in the media ran a headline suggesting Stanford finds genotype is not related to weight loss, so move on. Hmm. That's really not fair. We really didn't look at all of them. We looked at a few of them because we'd had a hint from a previous study, and that doesn't mean there aren't other people working on this that might have plausible ideas. But I also want to point out, it took us 5 years to test this one genotype signature with 609 people, so it's not an easy task to come up with a plausible genotype signature, and then test it and prove if it works and move on.
Right. So it does seem pretty complicated. And as we look at people's diets, there's so many different diets out there. And as we talked about at the top of the show, it can be so confusing to know what to eat. And it seems like as a result of this study, there is some advice about healthy low carb and healthy low fat. And, you know, Sue, can you, for our listeners, what would a healthy low carb fat or low carb lunch look like?
Well, let's say we'll take low carb. Uh-huh. So you get maybe a bed of greens or, you know, some cabbage or salad material, you know, or you could roast vegetables and you could have, well, if it's some greens, you could put a hard-boiled egg or a cooked egg on top. Like Christopher said, you know, they went really low in the first 8 weeks, but later on, if they could add in and still be maintaining a weight loss or losing it a little bit more that they wanted to and feeling good, they could add like some whole grains there. I mean, just like maybe half a cup, no more cooked, that kind of thing. Low fat would be something the same. I mean, they could also put, you know, nice olive oil on that, back to the low carb, on that bed of greens, or, you know, whatever oil, or hopefully more monounsaturated fat that they used to cook the greens, and that was fine. Low fat may be a little bit more emphasis on the grains and beans and some protein. Again, could be lean chicken. And again, with vegetables, it could be, you know, you roast some tomatoes, or you have, any kind of, you know, you cook an artichoke, all kinds of, in any sorts of eggplant, you know, roasted eggplant, things like that. And again, trying to use healthy fats.
It sounds delicious, I will say. Well, why, Christopher, did people have different outcomes? You talked about some people lost a tremendous amount of weight and some people ultimately gained a little bit of weight. What do you have? Do you have any sense of what accounts for that?
Sure. And actually, there's a nice article that came out by Julia Bellas from Vox just a couple days ago where she interviewed two of the really most successful people and two that struggled the most. So I'd love to point readers to Julia Bellas' article in Vox, and it was really a lot of stuff that was going on in life. Some of the things that we heard from the most successful people was that we helped them change their relationship to food. So what we haven't really talked about a lot lately is that in the show so far is that there are actually 22 classes. These lucky people got an hour for 22 different nights with Sue over the course of the year. First it was once a week, then every other week, then every third, then once a month. And if you can imagine, the principles of low fat and low carb are not really that hard to convey. Got that down in the first 8 weeks. And after that, they're helping both groups in the same way think about, okay, what happens on a holiday when you deviate? Don't beat yourself up. Get back on track fast. Don't eat in front of the TV. In fact, don't eat in front of any screen. Please go to the farmer's market. Try to cook more at home. Try to sit down with your family and eat. Don't be distracted. And really sort of a summary of all that would be eating more mindfully and less mindlessly. And I think what a couple people really caught on to was that they had been eating mindlessly. There's so many food cues around us all the time that they've been snacking and nibbling and grazing. And Sue and the other health educators got them to be much more mindful, and the way they reflected it back to us was saying that we had changed their relationship to food. They were just much more conscious of what was going on, whereas at the other end of the spectrum, we had divorces, we had people lose their jobs, people got in car accidents, their stress went up. Just as they joined the study, something really uncomfortable happened in their life, and it turned out that food was a comfort for them, and so, you know, it became hard to adhere to some of the guidelines, because that meant bringing them into something unfamiliar. And to get through their stressful period in life, they really needed something very familiar, including maybe a pint of Ben and Jerry's ice cream or something like that.
We've all been there.
Life happens. And so really what was fascinating was sort of these similar stories of mindfulness versus mindlessness, and how these, all this diet or eating pattern, all these changes in eating patterns had to happen in the larger context of life.
Well, that, I'd love to get back to that, but first, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guests tonight are Dr. Christopher Gardner, Director of Nutrition Studies at the Stanford Prevention Research Center and Professor of Medicine at Stanford University, and we also have Susan Kirkpatrick, a registered dietitian and certified diabetes educator at Inara Health. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Have you had trouble losing weight? Have you lost weight? And do you credit it to a particular diet? The number to call to join our conversation is 1-866-798-8255. That's 1-866-798-TALK. Or you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. So we had a question over email. Somebody wanted to ask, was portion control a factor in this study? Sue or Christopher?
Let Sue handle that one. Go for it, Sue.
Okay. Yes, we did go over portions. And, you know, and a lot of times it was the idea of, you know, fill up your plate mostly with these vegetables that crossed over between both diets. And, you know, so at least 50% of your plate is, you know, covered with those and piled as high as you want it to go. And then, you know, have a quarter or more if you were, again, it depended on what stage they were, but if you're low carb, then fill up the rest with, again, some egg or meat or chicken or fish or protein or whatever you want. And, you know, and again, and then the low fat, and then they both kind of came together, and then the other quarter is some whole grain, really high whole grain that's cooked and slowly cooked. You're not like, you know, quick instant oatmeal or anything like that. Nothing with added sugars if you possibly can. So in a way, we were teaching them portions. I mean, and we did even do, you know, some ideas of like how you can use your hand and your fingers and your thumb. But just visualize your plate like that. And we would show all kinds of pictures of wonderful plates like I described to you. And we even would do some little basic food demos and things like that to get that idea of, you know, quality food, but just enough that you need, kind of that idea, which is smaller portions. And we talked about also about, we did a whole bunch of a class, and we carried the theme through from time to time, about, Christopher talked about mindful eating, but when we talked about mindless eating, we did a lot of things about using a smaller plate. You know, things where, you know, we eat with our eye instead of our stomach, so let's, you know, trick our eye in a sense by, you know, pouring liquid into a tall, skinny glass and you pour less. Things like that. So we were doing this thing about portion control in the context of mindless and mindful eating, if that makes sense.
Right. So it wasn't exactly like eat 3 ounces of this or 4 ounces of that. It was more saying like if the quality of the diet is good, you can have as many vegetables as you want.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So we really, that theme of quality, we always tried to put that first and then describe things like from there, if that makes sense.
Yeah. We have a question from a listener over email. Did the study include African Americans, and did you categorize your participants by education or income levels?
So I'll take that one. We took
okay.
all comers. We probably had 60% Caucasian. We had 20% Hispanic. We had 10 or 15% Asian. We only had about 5% Black. That often happens in our area. East Palo Alto used to be a location for a lot of African Americans to live, and there's really a lot more Hispanics living there now. So the demographics have changed. So specifically for African Americans, it was low. We reached out to some churches. We tried some other methods, but we did not get a lot of them. But it was open to all ethnicities, so we took that into account. We asked everybody what their education was. It's the Bay Area, so we got a lot of well-educated people. We had a smattering of people with less than high school education, but not very many. We had, I can't remember, maybe 10% without a college education, but probably 90% had some college or a college education, and there's a whole other set that had graduate degrees.
Fascinating. We have a caller on the line, Mariella from Oakland. Mariella, are you there?
Oh, I'm doing fine, thank you. I have a question. Can pre-diabetic condition is it reversible or not? I just found out that I'm at that stage, and I'm 67 years old, and I'm very careful with my diet, and I exercise. I don't know what happened or how to, what does it, the cause? Is it my age, or, and I'm from Latin America, so I don't know.
That's a great question. Sue, is prediabetes reversible?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've worked with many clients who have, so is it Marciella or Mariella? Just, you know, you can absolutely get your blood sugar into normal range with continued good eating and exercise. I've seen it happen many, many times. And I would encourage you, if you haven't, to see a registered dietitian through your health plan if you have access to one. You know, they're great. I mean, it doesn't have to be a certified diabetes educator. It can be, but any dietitian can walk you through that. But yes, it is. It can be a factor of age to answer that question, and also family history, and also ethnicity as well. All those things can factor in, yes.
Well, that's good news to know that it's reversible. Let me ask you this. Why is it that processed food is so addicting? You know, the things that you're telling us, we shouldn't eat stuff with sugar or refined products. Why is that something that people crave?
Can I point you in a couple of directions?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So
we can both go there, I guess, but you go first.
couple of the books to read are Salt, Sugar, Fat by Michael Moss and The End of Overeating by David Kessler. There's another book called The Dorito Effect by Mark Schatzberg, I think is the name. And really, all of these hit on capitalism. And capitalism has food companies trying to sell food, and they get a lot of focus groups, and they make Cheezos and Weezos and multicolored marshmallows, breakfast cereals, and focus group after focus group comes in there. And Michael Moss really captured this with a term that probably will easily resonate with a lot of people, and it's the bliss point. So the bliss point is dialing up or down combinations of salt, sugar, and fat and layering them on top of each other. So I think those of us, at least on this call, are old enough to remember Lay's potato chips. You can't eat just one. They really studied that. Like dopamine reward pathways, fire in your brain, because that particular combination had the right crunch and the right smell and the right aftermouth, aftertaste. Everything was worked on with hundreds of people and dozens of focus groups, exactly that. So when the food cue came up, you would want it, and then you would want more. It's very intentional.
Well, are there foods that are good for you that replicate those same things of crunch and fat and salt that people might want to crave?
Well, so here's what we're doing. I've been working with the Culinary Institute of America, with chefs that are actually, there's a bunch of chefs out there now that are trying to be part of the solution. You know, historically, chefs were responsible for celebratory foods, but it turns out now about 50% of the foods Americans eat were designed in some menu and recipe by a chef, whether it be something at the local grocery store or the restaurant, or the wrapped-up burrito or bowl or something that you took. And they really have that culinary craft to make things. This is my favorite phrase from Greg Drescher, who's one of the vice presidents of the Culinary Institute of America. Make them unapologetically delicious. We're actually doing some studies with Stanford students in the dining halls where we're trying to see about framing the way we describe the food with signage, the way we present them, like the whole food experience can be manipulated so that healthy foods have that same kind of bliss point. So absolutely, chefs are helping us work on the bliss point for foods that are good for you and good for the environment.
And what about you, Sue? Why do you think processed food is so addictive and for people?
Well, I agree with everything Christopher said, and it was really interesting. We did touch on a lot of those books and some movies that have been out. But I also think too, in addition to everything Christopher said, is I just feel like they're not satisfying over time. You know, they don't, you know, I'd rather people, anybody, whether they were, you know, not necessarily in our study, but, you know, have something like Christopher saying, he used the term craveable, too, that you just really crave, but just, again, just a little something, you know, not so much. I mean, I do think we have an issue, back to that portion, with portions, but have craveable food, like really good food, like some really good blue cheese if you want it, not some manufactured, processed, where everything is taken out of it, and then like an hour later, you're like, you weren't satisfied, and you're craving more, you know? So I do think they leave people not satisfied, like you're just craving more food.
Mm. Well, let's talk about a little bit more about that, but first, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7, KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guests tonight are Dr. Christopher Gardner, Director of Nutrition Studies at the Stanford Prevention Research Center and Professor of Medicine at Stanford University. We also have Susan Kirkpatrick, a registered dietitian and certified diabetes educator at Anara Health. Please call in if you have any questions or comments. Is there a diet that you've ever tried that you liked? Is there a diet that you tried and you got off it and gained weight again? Let us know. The number to call to join our conversation is 1-866-798-8255. That's 1-866-798-TALK. Or you can email or text us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment on klw.org or our Facebook page, or you can send us a tweet at cityvisionsKALW. We have an email from a listener. She wants to know, well, how does metabolism, Debbie wants to know, how does metabolism affect diet, and does it change as you age, and can you somehow boost your metabolism through diet? Christopher?
Wow, that's an enormous question. So metabolism, sort of a catch-all term for everything that's happening physiologically and biochemically in your body. Can you ramp it up? Within a certain extent, but most of them are more similar than different. I will give you one example that came right out of our study. So, again, given that we're looking for some additional answers to try to figure out what the personalization part was about, picture this. I think a lot of listeners will resonate with this. If you're trying to lose weight, and you are losing weight, and you're cutting back on food, I think most people understand that there's a certain amount of energy that your body burns. It's called resting energy expenditure or basal metabolic rate. It's that amount of energy that's for your heart and your lungs and the rest of everything else. So even if you're not moving at all, you're actually burning calories. And it's actually, for most people, the largest portion of their calorie expenditure for the day, this basal metabolic rate. And when you start losing weight, your body freaks out a little bit and thinks evolutionarily, oh my God, here's one of those famine things again. I certainly don't want to starve. I want to survive. And so there's a little bit of capacity to lower your basal metabolic rate in response to weight loss. And that actually works against you. So as you're trying to eat less and burn more, your body passively is burning less by lowering this basal metabolic rate. So to bring this in the context of the listener's question, we saw quite a range of changes in basal metabolic rate. We saw a couple people losing weight with their basal metabolic rate going up. And we saw quite a few whose basal metabolic rate went down a lot. And then we saw some who were in the middle. So just speaking from a metabolic perspective, what's that about? What's that variability about, that someone's body did that? Is that something that we could learn to manipulate with food so that you could be burning more passively while you're trying to lose weight and maintain the weight loss? I don't have the answer to that question, but it is absolutely true. Almost all of us know somebody who can seem to eat everything and they're still rail thin, and we know somebody who seems to not eat so much and they can't keep off the pounds. So certainly there are metabolic differences like this basal metabolic rate, but we don't really understand what it is that we can control it at this point.
There are so many different diets out there. It's incredibly confusing, and there seems to be any that you can choose from. So I wanted to ask you both, just what do you guys think about intermittent fasting? Is that something that is worth looking at?
Happy to take a crack. Do you want to go, Sue? Go first, Sue.
Okay. You know, just like our plan or our advice, I mean, It works for some people. I have worked with some people, you know, outside of the study again, that do intermittent fasting, and it works for them. And the same thing, just like the variability of our study. I know others who have tried it, and it's like, oh, I just cannot do that, you know. Most of the time, the people who tell me it doesn't work, it's because of their lifestyle. Again, it's because, you know, life happens to them, and during this period of time of the day when they're trying to not eat, you know, whether it's their job, but it's mostly their environment intercedes. And that's what happened on our study, meaning, you know, you think about it, what's at the office, you know, in the break room, and or what your colleague is eating in the next desk over, and things like that, where it just becomes untenable and unsustainable to keep it going. But those that can adhere to it, it can help some people, yes.
Right. And what about kids? Is there anything special for kids, or is this something that, you know, children should be thinking about too, low fat, low carb, as a healthy way to eat?
Well,
no.
You know, that's a hard one. I think, well, children are still growing, you know, and it depends on, you know, what age we're talking about here, but I mostly try to tell, you know, the parents of my clients, or, you know, my clients themselves, if they're younger, you know, eat well, eat, you know, try not to eat so much junk food and sugar, the same sort of message, and be active, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really up to also parents or whoever else is in the household or the gatekeepers of the food to model that behavior to those children as well. So I often challenge people, like parents, who say, who might be following some plan or trying to lose weight, and they're doing something different than the family. So, oh, you know, this is so hard. I'm doing something different, and I have to cook differently. And I say, well, why do you have to do that? Because, again, we're trying to promote quality foods and just not eat so much. So that's not really a diet. That's just a practice for everybody. So I try to get people to turn it around like that in their minds.
Christopher, what is it that in some places a person can be really satiated by a certain type of meal, but for another person that wouldn't be satisfying? What accounts for that?
Well, I can't tell you what accounts for it, but that is absolutely the next direction that we would love to move. So, you know, right in the middle of doing this study, we had had some old guidelines about the best diet for losing weight. And since 1998, some of the old guidelines basically only said low fat. There's only one diet and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Right in the middle of our study in 2014, a new set of guidelines came out. And fascinatingly, it listed vegan, vegetarian, Mediterranean, low carb, Atkins, Zone. And it said, we've looked and there are studies that show some people can lose weight on all those diets. There isn't any one diet that everybody loses weight on, but some can lose it on all. And that always involves cutting back on calories. That was the one consistent thing across all of them. But the fascinating thing to tie into your question right there was that when they looked across the studies, a set of them had very intentionally prescribed cutting back a certain number. Like for a lot of these, it's either 500 calories a day or 1,000 calories a day less than you normally eat, which is just depressing listening to that, isn't it? I mean, doesn't it feel hungry?
It does make me feel hungry now, yeah.
And then they said some of the other studies actually achieved or realized a calorie restriction without counting. And this has really been a highlight of finishing the study and for us looking at it in more detail, because we had never planned to address that. We just never had a caloric prescription that they should cut back on. We said, eat whole foods, don't be hungry, lower your fat or lower your carbs. There's some specific foods to avoid, but boy, enjoy a lot of foods. Should work in a social setting with your family. So our participants reported eating hundreds of calories less per day in the year that they were in the study, but we actually never told them how many to cut back on. And they really did achieve this collective 6,500 pounds of weight loss. And so my take on this, getting back to one of the earlier questions, is that I think there's some people out there that have steel-cut oats for breakfast and they have lentil soup for lunch, and then you compare that to somebody else who wasn't satiated. One person was satiated for that, one person isn't. The other person instead has these eggs for breakfast, they smear avocado all over them, they have some nuts and some salmon later for lunch, and that fat, not in large portions, but that fat fill them up if they're really being mindful about it. And somebody else, the signal doesn't quite hit them, and that fat has 9 calories per gram, and they end up eating more, and the calorie restriction doesn't happen. So I think life hacking yourself, or biohacking, is kind of a fun term these days. I think if you're on this low, no sugar, low, no refined carbs, lots of veggies, there's plenty of room to play around with either the steel-cut oats lentil low-fat version or the avocado nuts and fatty salmon low-carb version to see how you feel satiated. When do you stop eating sooner? And what tides you over longer till the next meal? I think that is the next frontier to help people personalize their ability to manage weight and weight loss maintenance.
Mm-hmm. But both of them sound delicious to me. And this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guests tonight are Dr. Christopher Gardner, Director of Nutrition Studies at the Stanford Prevention Research Center and Professor of Medicine at Stanford University. Also, Susan Kirkpatrick, a registered dietitian and certified diabetes educator at Inara Health. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to call in is 1-866-798-8255. That's 1-866-798-TALK. You can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or our Facebook page. We had a question from a listener. She asks, what advice do you give about wine, alcohol, or beer? I think that people are hoping there's a yes there, but Christopher, Sue, what do you think about that?
Well, I'll go first. Drinking came up quite often in the study, and rightfully so, especially if at the beginning when we were telling people, you can look at this as a budget of 20 grams of fat or 20 grams of carb, and so it's a totally legitimate question. So we went into the caloric impact of, even though, again, we didn't tell them to restrict calories, we just told them, well, this is what it is. How many calories if you drink this big of a, glass of wine or that ounce of a beer or whatever, or this is, has more carbs. But we didn't promote it, and we didn't ignore it. But it was an issue for some people. It absolutely was, and they admitted it later on. And so we gave them the general guidelines, and also just do this in moderation, just like everything else, but you've got to count it as part of your plan, kind of thing.
Right. We have a question from Karen in Berkeley. What do you think about monotrophic eating, where you only eat one kind of type of food at a time?
Well, we don't think very much of that. That's not going to work. So our nutrients that keep us healthy are spread across a wide range of foods. So anything like that could potentially lead to a nutrient deficiency. One of the reasons it's going to work for weight loss is that when you just focus on one food, even if it's your favorite food in the world, the palatability starts to run out fast. If you were to sort of picture your favorite cheese, just for an example, which is full of calories, and put 100 one-ounce servings in front of you, and that first one is awesome, the second one's good, the third one's okay. If you were to get to the 88th, you'd be ready to gag. So if you're really just on one type of food, and you have a rule in your mind, I'm only going to eat that one, then it turns out pretty soon you're not hungry for that. You're hungry for other things, but you're not hungry for that. So if you're pretty resolute, and you're really just going to stick with that, it would really help you cut back on calories. In our hands, that would not be something that we would promote, because we want long-term pattern. That is not a sustainable long-term pattern.
Good to know. And Alice, a listener on Facebook, asks, how do eating disorders and body image play into this? And what do you think about health at any size? All sizes are okay. Sue,
do you want to take a turn? Back and forth.
Yeah, back and forth. I have to say, body image certainly comes into play in any, again, weight loss program or study, I believe. We're a society where we really focus on that, and there's just no doubt about it. Weight you know, carries a big stigma. And, you know, this is something I thought about in the study, too. And so it was, so body image or, you know, your perception of, you know, what you weigh, it says so much about you. Despite that, we would all, you know, five of us would tell them, you know, you're more than the number on the scale. And even though it was hard, you know, because this is a weight loss study, but, you know, look at it from a health perspective, that was still there. And I think that's why a lot of people fell out, because they thought they let the study down and they let us down, they let themselves down. And there was a shame factor, I think, even though they didn't come out and say it. I have felt this many, many times, and I know this to be true. And the question about eating disorders, we call it now, I see more disordered eating instead of eating disorders. And disordered eating, you know, and I'm correcting that, or not correcting it, I'm just defining it, because back in the day when you said eating disorders, we think of a very underly, thin, unhealthy person. But we don't have much of that anymore. I mean, that still exists, but we have people who are, you know, their eating patterns and their weight is just completely discombobled. And there's actually binge eating now, which is now like, is treatable. I mean, it's not the majority of the population, but it is out there. And I do know that there are a couple people in a study, I know this post-study, that really, that was a challenging aspect of them being in the study.
Right. Well, we talked now about healthy fats, and maybe 15 years ago, we really didn't talk about healthy fats. And now it seems that sugar, refined sugar, is kind of a pernicious thing in people's diets. Do you think we'll ever get to the point where we'll consider healthy sugar, or is that just not something that would be found good for your diet?
Nope, no healthy sugar. We eat way too much of it. There's 27 different names for it. Honey isn't really any better than molasses, isn't any better than high fructose corn syrup. So the problem with all those, they don't come with nutrients. They're really just strings of carbohydrates. They get rapidly digested, rapidly absorbed, and it's a challenge for your body to put them away. It really is. And interestingly, I was just working on a paper with somebody where I kept saying sugar, and they kept correcting my type, saying sugars. And I said, that sounds really weird. And they said, okay, but think about it, really. If you're in the food industry, there isn't just sugar. There's maltose, dextrose, high fructose corn syrup, all those different names they come up with, and it's sugars. And if you're a practical person looking on the label, and you say, oh, I looked, and sugar is nowhere near the top three, and I know they order these by weight, so there must not be much sugar in it. So you look, and there's 12 different kinds of sugars in there, and they ordered them by weight, and collectively it would have been the number one ingredient, except they were smart enough to trick you and spread them out throughout all the ingredients. And it really is added sugars. They add sugars to everything. Mm-hmm. It's quite a hook for selling things. Our palates are suckers for it. I'm sure we're evolutionarily attuned to it. It's something we sought out, you know, thousands, millions of years ago. So it is pernicious. Okay, I'm putting my foot down here, and I'm usually a pretty open-minded guy. Sugars will never be healthy.
Well, I think that's a bright line rule. That's a bright line rule. Well, Joan wrote in an email, and she said, well, do you have any advice on how to get rid of sugar in your diet?
Oh, so interestingly, we have another program, and I'd love your listeners to sign up for this. It's the WELL program. We have a WELL registry in our research group. And so you just go WELL at Stanford, look that up, and you can join. We've got thousands of people who are sort of citizen scientists, and we're exploring different things with them. And I'm bringing that up because we presented them with a sugar detox, and it was really fun. About 150 people signed up for the sugar detox, and a lot of them chronicled what was going on. And I'm going to tell you how successful and yet how challenging it was. It's not really all that hard to identify where the sugars are coming from and to make this resolute rule. I, for 1 week, am not going to have any sugars. And if you are fairly addicted to sugars, which is true of a bunch of people, you'll have symptoms of withdrawal for a couple of days. But interestingly, for a lot of people, withdrawal the symptoms went away quicker than they thought. Then they felt more clear-headed, more alert, less fatigued. But the other thing we heard from them was that they just cheated a little after gaining that handle on sugar. They just cheated a little. It came back with a vengeance, and they had to have another bite, and another bite, and another bite. So it's a fascinating topic. You can get a handle on it. You have to be pretty resolute about it. And you can create this new habit, but I will warn all the listeners that we have figured out it's good. Hardwired into your brain, and to overwrite that wiring isn't just a 1 or 2 day or a week process. It would take a while, but it can be done.
I would like to interject too. I remember this through all the different groups, the different cohorts, that once they got the sugar out of their diet, and then later on when it started slipping back in, after that initial sort of washout, many of them would tell me, oh, my God, I actually felt sick after going back to it.
Hmm.
So what that told me was you can retrain your palate and your whole, you know, your brain and everything to not have to need it and to then start craving, back to the question previously, just good food. Our bodies can get used to good things and bad things. So if we just... if we just take time, it's really, over time, you can just not crave it anymore. And actually, when you start eating it again, it almost makes you feel ill.
Well, if you're somebody who really likes sweets, what's a good way to get that that kind of flavor profile into your diet, but in a healthy way? Is that fruit?
Can I give you the Culinary Institute of America approach? It's called the dessert flip. So instead of going and having this massive piece of cheesecake with a raspberry on top, have a bowl of raspberries with a dollop of cheesecake on top of the raspberries. So you get the sweet fix. You didn't deprive yourself. You didn't avoid it completely. But it was mostly a bowl of fruit.
And I think that also goes to that concept of, you know, have that craveable food, but again, it's a flip. It's, you know, the piece that's more sugary is not the overpowering or is taking up most of the plate or the dish or whatever, but you're getting that taste, and so you get that just what you need.
Well, that sounds delicious. I mean, it all sounds good, all the food that you're offering as advice to our listeners. We're going to put a lot of the resources, I just want to let our listeners know, that Sue and Christopher have mentioned on our website. And that last website you said, that was Well at Stanford, Christopher?
Yeah, I'm going to help you get exactly the right URL for that, I promise.
Perfect. Let's quickly go through some of the other diets that we hear a lot about. There's something called a blood type diet. Does that work?
So that one's brilliant. Well, it definitely doesn't work for me. So
I don't think I've heard anyone that actually works for.
Yeah, apparently for me, I'm supposed to be a meat eater, according to my blood type. And I'm 59, and Sue will vouch for me. I'm pretty healthy. Even though I'm going against my blood type, there's something brilliant about that, which is it's almost impossible to refute. You have to find a bunch of people with all the different blood types we have and classify them appropriately to diet, and then get a whole other set of people that you misassign to the wrong one, and then you'd have to wait. So what is it that would be healthy about them? Would it be glucose control? Would it be weight? Would it be heart disease or cancer, diabetes or stroke? So a challenge there is there's a lot of different health outcomes, and you can't measure them all at once in one study. And it would take an enormous number of different groups of people to get properly assigned and inappropriately assigned to each one of the blood type diets. So I don't think anybody that I've ever known has tried putting it to the test. And there's certainly a placebo effect that if you try something and you're being more conscious about it, that could lead you to be more mindful and successful right off the bat. You might attribute it to it was the blood type diet. But in fact, you can't really do that until you test it in the way that I was trying to describe.
Well, having completed the study and put so much time and effort into it, have the results changed how you approach your own health, or do they really affirm how you've been living your life already? Sue?
I'm not perfect by any means. I think I was thinking about this earlier, I did change some things. You know, it struck me after watching one of the movies, too, that we are fond of, that you know, my husband and I both said, wow, we could do better, you know? And so while I've been, you know, I'm not a red meat eater for a long time, I didn't pay as much attention to, again, like I was telling you, what we told our participants, you know, grass-fed or I don't eat red meat, but when I buy my eggs now, I want them to come from a chicken that's out in the, you know, pecking in the pasture. And I get a CSA box regularly, a community-supported agriculture, and I try to get involved in more gardening and garden shares and things like that. So, yes, it changed not so much the way I eat, but sort of my sort of relationship with some of my own foods. There you go.
How about you, Christopher?
I've been kind of life hacking my own diet for a long time. I really never get sick. I have always tons of an insane amount of energy. So nothing I think would sway me. I'm always experimenting with new things, although I am a lifelong vegetarian and mostly vegan. I try different cooking things. I try some different grains and some different cultures, Indian food or Latin American food. I'm always open to a new experience. For me, the most fun about the study was having five incredibly intelligent health educators who'd been counseling patients and clients for quite a while and sitting around a room with them saying, okay, you guys all, to be part of the study, have to teach low fat and low carb, and you have to do it with equal enthusiasm. And you can just see it rumbling around in their brain a little, thinking, well, you know, I kind of think one's better than the other. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this with equal enthusiasm. I know it's for the sake of science. And then months later, we sat around the table, and the stories they told were really staggering, because they said, wow, you know, this is really shaking me up a little bit, because I've really seen some people fail doing what I thought was right and succeed doing what I previously thought was wrong. I don't know if I'm misstating or overstating. Do you want to, can you jump in there and save me if I did that wrong?
No, you didn't do that wrong at all. I mean, that is so true. You know, we all came in, I can't say exactly what one of my other health educators, you know, thought which one was better than another, but we all brought some bias to it, absolutely. And, you know, I want to say something. I just want to thank the participants. They taught me quite a bit, and to the point where, because later on, as Christopher described, as the study went on, you know, we talked about things like Christopher said, like mindless and mindful eating and what something we called food rehab, and we got them talking with each other. You know, we really tried to make it more interactive, because that's the thing that I saw was, like, there are two things. People want accountability, and they want connection.
Yes.
You know, and so that was even the bigger piece, sort of that. It wasn't something that I didn't think was true before.
Yes.
We had the...
Sue, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. That's been City Visions
anyway,
for this...
That taught me a lot to give them time to tell their story.
That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Dr. Christopher Gardner, Director of Nutrition Studies at Stanford Prevention Research Center, and Susan Kirkpatrick, a registered dietitian and certified diabetes educator at Enora Health. Thanks to you both for joining us. For a link to this and other City Visions show to tell us what you thought about the program, please go to our City Visions page at KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was Debbie Kennedy. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join us next week as we discuss teenage activism around gun control. This is Grace Wan. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.